Hello and welcome to the Advocacy Institute's Experts on the Record. Today is November 1, 2013, and this is Candace Cordiella, Director at the Institute. As most states move rapidly toward implementation of the Common Core state standards or their own more rigorous academic standards, exactly how students with disabilities can be appropriately included in this effort is getting lots of attention. Along with the substantial increase in rigor in what students need to know and do in English language arts and math, is the shift in the focus of monitoring announced by the Office of Special Education Programs at the U.S. Department of Education. The department is working to retool its monitoring practices to shift the focus from a system focused primarily on compliance with the IDEA to one that puts more emphasis on educational results and functional outcomes for students with disabilities. This shift is in focus is known as results-driven accountability. But just how we go about improving the educational results of students with disabilities is a topic that needs a lot of work and examination. So we're talking today with Kalman Hedelman, who has developed a model that is designed to substantially improve the academic performance of students with disabilities. So let's get started. Welcome, Mr. Hedelman.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your own leadership in this effort to focus on results-driven accountability.
Thank you. So, first of all, why don't you tell our listeners exactly how you got involved in the area of special education?
Well, I am not an educator by profession. I am a lawyer by trade, but have spent most of my working life in government and community organizations, including with a focus on issues affecting urban poverty. In terms of education, I was the deputy mayor for two mayors of Baltimore, and schools were part of my portfolio there. I served on the Baltimore City School Board in the early 1970s. I was involved in some early reading initiatives in the 80s. And then around the end of the 90s, I decided to leave a full-time job and work on education policy analysis and program development and advocacy. And in a sense, then I more or less stumbled into special education, starting first with a report that I wrote that was very critical of the Vaughn G. case in Baltimore City, that was focused almost exclusively on procedural compliance, that began in 1984, was still running in the year 2000, and ran on until 2012, and in my view, was missing the ball, was costing a lot of money, was generating a lot of paperwork, but it wasn't resulting in better academic outcomes and functional outcomes for students with disabilities. So from there, having been critical of the compliance focus and having had an interest in early reading for a long time, I wrote another report called The Invisible Dyslexics. And whenever I reference to a report, they're published by the Able Foundation in Baltimore. And the Invisible Dyslexics focused on discrimination against poor children in the diagnosis and treatment of early reading difficulties. And virtually all of those kids wind up in special education. In the course of doing that research, I started to represent on a pro bono basis students with disabilities. That was in the early 2000s. I have by now represented well over 150 students, most of them in Baltimore City, again on a pro bono basis. So I've gone from sort of the policy tower to the trenches in terms of issues affecting IEPs. I then wrote another report, I think it was in 2004, called The Road to Nowhere, The Illusion and Broken Promises of Special Education in the Baltimore City and Other Public School Systems, and documented how IEP goals and services and outcomes were falling short of what the law required. And I conceptualized a framework that became known as the one-year-plus policy, which is now implemented system-wide in Baltimore City, is being implemented sort of piecemeal in the surrounding Baltimore County, and has gathered a lot of support from national experts, including a meeting that was held, and you were there, fortunately, with Mr. Michael Uden of the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Special Education Rehabilitation. And it is gaining traction as one of the few models or ways out there to specifically not only shift the focus, but hold school systems accountable for better student performance. So that's a bit of a long answer, but that's sort of the genesis.
Okay, well, thank you. And we will remind our listeners that we have links to all of your writings and reports on our website at the advocacyinstitute.org. So tell us what the essential components of 1 year plus. The name implies that, I think, the basic thrust of the program, which is to, in fact, enable students with disabilities to make more than 1 year's progress in an academic school year, and that progress is driven by their IEP goals and the formulation, the manner in which those goals are formulated. So give us a little primer on 1 year plus.
One more piece of backdrop, which is that I went on the Baltimore City School Board for the second time in the year 2005. I was part of the process in which we hired Dr. Andres Alonso, who had been a special education teacher in Newark for many years before becoming an administrator. And he bought into the concept of 1 year plus, but it took several years to really get it cooking. And it was rolled out system-wide in not this school year, but last school year. And what it the basis for it is the expectation and legal right that students with disabilities, that the great majority of students with disabilities should be expected to achieve grade level standards and are capable of achieving grade level standards without modifications. And so we have the basic division, which is more a continuum than a neat division between students who are on certificate tracks and students who are on diploma tracks. Most directly, 1 year plus applies to students on a diploma track who should not be getting modifications that lower the standards, and students who are on a certificate track, but the principle is still the same. And while it's difficult to set standards for students who are more severely cognitively disabled, there's no reason why experts in the field shouldn't be doing that, and we shouldn't be holding school systems accountable for students meeting those standards with the proper modifications. So the first step is the legal right and the expectation that students should be able to achieve grade level standards. And so what 1 year plus goes on and says is that if students are behind their grade level, where there's a gap between their enrolled grade and their performance level, say Johnny's in the sixth grade reading at a third grade level, then Johnny is entitled to goals that enable him to achieve 1 year progress plus a reasonable reduction in the 3 year gap, which will be a 4 year gap unless more progress is made in the year of the IEP. And what the practice has been in Baltimore, and I've handled many of these cases in Baltimore City and some in Baltimore County, is usually, and everything is individualized and kids differ considerably, but usually it is the reduction is maybe 3 to 6 months. And IEP performance levels and goals are usually stated, let's say, as early, mid, or late, say third grade or fourth grade in reading fluency or reading comprehension, or call it what you will, so that frequently Johnny, let's say Johnny's at the third grade in reading comprehension, let's say he's at the mid-third grade, the goal will say that he will go to the late fourth grade at the end of the year of the annual IEP. Now, it's a heck of a lot easier to state a goal than to enable a student to achieve the goals. So the real essence of 1 year plus is that these goals are expectations, not aspirations. And the IEP team must be ready to state that based on research and professional judgment that the services that Johnny will get are, here are keywords, reasonably calculated, and actually they come from the Supreme Court decision, that are reasonably calculated to enable Johnny to achieve the goals. Goals are not guarantees. Anything can happen. Johnny's disability can change. Some other problem may affect his attendance or so forth and so on. But assuming that Johnny's disability stays pretty much, and circumstances stay pretty much the same, the services that he receives should be reasonably calculated to enable him to achieve the goals. Now, there is one more very important, and at least in my experience, ignored aspect of this. Everyone in the business agrees that under IDEA, Johnny must have access to the general education curriculum. But what does that mean? The way it is unfortunately and erroneously interpreted to mean is that Johnny can access his content courses through most usually, let's say, verbatim reading or the read-aloud accommodation. And I've represented many students who get the read-aloud accommodation in the first or second grade. Now, it's one thing for Johnny, who's in the ninth grade and reading at a third or fourth grade level, to have his literature and his science and his social studies and his math problems read to him so he can access those courses. But at the same time, whether Johnny's in the second grade or the fifth grade or the sixth grade or the 11th grade, Johnny should receive goals and services that enable him to improve his foundational skills in reading, math, and written language. In other words, sure, let Johnny access grade level content no matter how far behind he is, but at the same time, school systems should not get off the hook by teaching Johnny to read independently. So, needless to say, all of this is a big leap for most, for virtually all school systems. I don't know of any school system in the country that is doing this, that has basically enforced the legal right, as you know, as I've said it. But it's the right thing to do, and hopefully this podcast and the work of the Advocacy Institute and the work of a lot of others will encourage or pressure school systems to address this. And as the U.S. Department of Education looks for ways to get results-driven accountability, I don't know how you can do that without dealing with the basic elements of 1 year plus, starting with the expectation and the rights of students to have services that will enable them to meet the standards.
That's right. And as we mentioned at the beginning, the shift to the Common Core State Standards, we think, is also a wonderful opportunity for states and districts to move towards a practice we call standards-based IEPs. We wrote a guide for the National Center for Learning Disabilities for parents about standards-based IEPs. And essentially, I think that's a nice way to undergird the one-year plus approach, because the other thing that I think happens all too often is that the students' present level of performance, as well as the goals, neither of them are relating at all to the expectations in reading and math for that student at their enrolled grade level. And so we have situations where, you know, parents are finding out after 5 years of having their kid in special education that, as you indicated, they've made, you know, minimal progress and in fact have gotten further behind. And then remediating that achievement gap becomes harder and harder as the older the student gets. So, we're also hoping that we can get some traction on standards-based IEPs in the context of the Common Core State Standards, and as well as results-driven accountability. So you seem to feel that special education students are being accommodated a lot more than they are being remediated. Is that
absolutely? And that, again, it's almost tragic to see IEPs where students are getting. I was just working on preparing a case for next week, and the student was given verbatim reading in the first grade, and this is an LD student. This is not a student who is severely intellectually limited. And so when you're right on target with respect to this is embedded into standards-based IEPs. But what folks have to understand is that we're really, although it's complicated, there are two kinds of standards. One is the contents, well, they're all standards, but Johnny, when you go to write the goals, here's what is happening practically speaking in Baltimore City. So you go to write the goal for Johnny, who a year from now will be in the seventh grade, and the goal is that he will go from the middle of the third grade in reading comprehension to late fourth grade in reading comprehension a year from now. So how do you actually write the goal? Well, as a practical matter, in Baltimore, the goal is being written at the mid-fourth grade level. It's not being written at his enrolled grade level. And as a practical matter, the goal that Johnny will achieve his content standards in what will, you know, next year be the seventh grade. I've lost track of what grade, but that's implicit. It's not explicit. I mean, you could have a goal that's cross-curricular that says Johnny's going to have access to his curriculum and pass his grade level courses without phony grades, but that's not the practice. The practice was prior to 1 year plus is that the goal would be written at the seventh or eighth grade level, even though Johnny started at the third grade level, so it was meaningless. There was no accountability for how much progress would actually be expected. So, I mean, school systems have to change their mindset. They need to shift, you know, the focus and understand what the law requires and what science tells us. What science tells us are the expectations that these students can achieve the standards if they get the right instruction.
So one of the things that we discussed when we had our meeting with the folks at the U.S. Department of Education was the involvement of other specialists in development of the goals and as well as the instruction that will, you know, be used to get the kids to that goal. One of the things that I was impressed with is that there's real involvement with reading experts, you know, in that process, and bringing them in has helped to illuminate for some of the special educators that, in fact, the approach that they're taking, particularly to reading remediation, is frequently not based on the best science and research that we have. And so that's kind of been an eye-opening experience. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's it's a struggle. As you suggest, I mean, many general and special educators don't really know the research, and we don't have to go into the reading wars and all that, but they don't know the research on best practices, or they'll say, oh, well, we've got this Wilson program, or we've got some other Orton-Gillingham, or we've got Reed 180 or something like that. Oh, and this is a research-based program. But what they don't look at is the elements that go into that being an effective intervention, like how much time, in what size group is it going to be taught to 12 kids or 3 kids? Are they relatively homogeneous in their grade level? Is the teacher trained in that particular program? So practice falls short. Now, in fairness, some of it is money. It takes more money to provide more one-to-one, one-to-three tutoring, which so many of these kids need.
Right.
On the other hand, we can do better, and Baltimore City is doing better with the money at hand if it is better spent and if the teacher's expectations are raised. And you know, it cuts across so many fields. Children and adults perform to what people expect of them. And so here it's a matter of just raising the expectations will have some impact. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it certainly is the starting place. And in Baltimore, while we do not as yet have a formal evaluation, we do have monitoring. of an unscientific sample, and the results so far look good. And to some extent, I think the good results are the result of the Hawthorne effect. If you raise expectations and look over somebody's shoulder, they're going to do better. And some of it is they're just squeezing out additional instructional time. But it's a long process. I don't want to suggest that 1 year plus is, you know, a surefire bet, but it certainly is better. And what I hope the Baltimore City school system and others will relate to is an R&D process of research and development. This is going to take years of continuous improvement. And hopefully, if we can show that more intensive tutoring can really make a difference under what and under the certain circumstances, then we're gonna have a better case to get more money, as some other things do, you know, early childhood, summer learning. I mean, as we slowly accumulate knowledge about what works, then we have a stronger case in the political arena to get the money to do it or to redirect.
So I'm sure that that the school teams have a different approach to their to their IEP meetings when you're on the scene. Talk a little bit about the role that parents need to play here. If you're working with 100 plus students, that I'm assuming that means you're also working with 100 plus parents.
Right.
And I think that
and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of students who don't have advocates.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, but they all have parents. So I think one of the other challenges here for us is to, in order for what we've been talking about to really get some traction and get traction that has some urgency to it. Okay, we need to enlist the parents of all of these students. I mean, there's 2.4 million students just identified as specific learning disabilities in the country. So if we just worked on that chunk of those kids, what is it that those parents have to start doing differently in order to begin to accentuate the progress?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more that parents, of course, are key. A couple of very specific things. One is that there is a brochure that's been developed that spells out the basics of 1 year plus, and there is now a directive that this is to be handed out to parents and explained at the same time as other procedural safeguards are. Now, is that happening? Not as consistently as it should be, and hopefully we will go back and monitor that and strengthen that. Also, the school system is taking the initiative to have the parents sign off at the end of the meeting something to the effect that they have understood this and that this the principles of 1 year plus have been applied in the meeting. So hopefully those steps, if they're implemented, could go a long way.
Yes, and we have a link to the parent brochure on our 1 year plus page on our website. So, and I have it right here on my desk, and it's very very nice. So,
and the sign off sheet at the end is in the process of being developed.
Okay. Well, I think that you have given us a lot to think about. I know that.
And worry over. Welcome. I've lost every. I only had a few hairs to begin with, but anyway, it's you know, it's these systems are very entrenched.
Right.
But they're people want to do. Let's, you know, and you're such a leader in this struggle, so we keep going at it.
Yes, we will do that. So, and I think that what you're offering Baltimore City and beyond is, you know, something that can, it's not so complex that, you know, it needs to take years and years to implement. So we're hoping that the work that you've done can
and the schools, you know, and of course lots of people in the school system.
Yeah.
You know, it is a school system policy, and again, while there's been at different times pockets of resistance, the leadership of the school system has been committed to it.
That's right, and it won't happen without that. So thank you for being with us today. We hope that our listeners will learn more about 1 year plus, read your paper, understand the manner in which you anchor this to the legal rights of students with disabilities and students in special education, which I think is you know, something that people need to take a few minutes to try to understand. And then this kind of all falls into place nicely. So we will continue to keep an eye on your work and wish you all the best. And
we
thank
will be
you
keeping
so much.
An eye on your work, which is so important to this effort. Thank you.
Bye.